To today's colloquium. Today's speaker is John Yard. John did his PhD in Stanford, got that in 2005, then he did postdocs at McGill and Caltech, and now he is at Los Alamos. He's a Feynman Fellow. The last time I saw John give a talk, it was at the end of a conference, and immediately at the end of the talk, rather than taking questions, he ran and jumped into the sea. This was in Barbados, not in Washington, but there is a lake. just here. He had been instructed by the organizers to do this. Today, John is going to speak on quantifying entanglement with quantum entanglement. Thank you.
So today I'm going to talk mostly about some somewhat recent work I did with Fernando Brandão and Matthias Cristandel, where we found some new properties of quantum entropy, in particular. These implied some new facts about an entanglement measure called squashed entanglement. And I'll also kind of try to point to how more thought along these lines might lead to insights for various problems ranging from computing channel capacities to understanding the nature of things like topological order. So just to start off, So Shannon's information theory, basically Claude Shannon showed that you could answer certain fundamental questions in communication theory by considering certain functionals of probability distributions, such as the entropy. So the entropy of some random variable x with distribution p of x is just minus the expected log of the probabilities. And so the entropy winds up answering a fundamental question, namely, what's the ultimate rate at which you can do data compression? So how well can you compress some source of IID data that's described according to this distribution? And related quantities, such as the mutual information, arise in describing the ultimate communication capacities or the channel capacity of a communication channel. So in this talk, I'm mostly going to be talking about quantum entropy. So here, quantum entropy is given by, or von Neumann entropy, this formula here. Minus the trace of rho log rho, where rho is some density matrix. Okay, so this is Shannon's famous paper, which came out, I guess, over 60 years ago. So what about quantum entanglement? Okay, so what is entanglement? So if I have two Hilbert spaces, A and B, then I have the set of product states, or the product pure states, are just where I have a state on A and a state on B. Okay, so these are the states that are not entangled, and any other pure state is entangled. So to give you an example, the EPR state right here, where it's both in the 0,0 and the 1,1 state at the same time. This is sort of a standard unit of entanglement in a certain sense. So it's straightforward to quantify entanglement for pure states. Namely, it's just given by the entanglement entropy, where given some pure state here, I produce the partial trace. I take the reduced density matrix on one side. And this is just the von Neumann entropy of that density matrix. And it winds up being the same. It doesn't matter if I take A or B, because basically these guys have the same spectra, modulo some zeros. So just to give a somewhat concrete example, imagine that I have the ground state of some Hamiltonian on a lattice of spins. Okay, so now I can take the system A to be all the spins, or the Hilbert spaces of all the spins inside this region here. And I can take the Hilbert space B be the rest of the spins, or the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of those spins. And so it's believed that in a large number of cases, if you have, say, a gapped system, so if there's some gap between the lowest energy eigenstate of the Hamiltonian and the next excited state, that the entropy of this region is going to grow roughly like the area. Okay, so it's going to be some constant here, some non-universal constant, times the length of the boundary of this region. So not the area region, but the area of the boundary. And so roughly the conjecture is that this is going to grow like this, minus some sort of universal term here that captures, in a sense, the long-range entanglement, which I'll get to later. This has something to do with topological entanglement entropy. But you know, when I say that this quantifies the entanglement, the entropy quantifies it, what exactly do I mean by that? So we can make a precise statement on the basis of the data compression problem. So going back to the classical theory, so Shannon's data compression says the following. Imagine that I have some random data here given by a sequence of random variables, each one having the same distribution P of X. So I can define the compression protocol in terms of some encoding function here that maps every possible sequence into some collection of bits. So here, let's just say NR. So I've got NR bits that I take N copies of the random variable here. And then I'm going to send this to a receiver here who's going to try to decode it and invert this encoding function, produce some reconstructed data here. So the goal is to minimize the amount of stuff that we send. So to reduce the number of bits, so this rate R, while making negligible errors in the limit as the number of copies gets large. So namely, we want to have this probability that the whole sequence is wrong go to zero as n goes to infinity. We want to maximize the rate under this constraint. So Shannon's theorem is that the best, or in the sense of being the smallest, compression rate is given precisely by the entropy. So in fact, what he shows is that if you try to send it some rate smaller than the entropy, then this is going to go to 1 exponentially fast. And any rate less than the entropy will let this go to 0 exponentially fast. So this illustrates, in a sense, the philosophy of information theory here, where we have some error criterion. We deal with strings of things that are getting large strings. And we try to optimize rates. And in the end of the day, what we wind up finding is an operational interpretation of the entropy. It tells us what this means in the sense of communication theory. So it's the answer to a fundamental question. So a natural quantum generalization of this was found by Schumacher, called the Schumacher data compression. And here we just kind of change a couple of the elements here. We imagine now instead of some random variables, we have some random states, okay? And let's, for the sake of, for now, let's just think of these states as being drawn according to some probability distribution P of X. But again, they're independently drawn. So you have psi of X is chosen with P of X. And the encoder doesn't know the identities of these states. He's just given some quantum systems that he knows are drawn according to this distribution, according to this ensemble. And now the encoder does some operation, which is now some sort of a quantum physical operation. And instead of outputting n bits, he outputs n qubits. Okay, so some state on this Hilbert space here that's of dimension 2 to the nr. All right, so I should say this is nr qubits, not n qubits. And then he sends these nr qubits over to a receiver who does some other decoding operation, another physical operation, and produces some output density matrix here on this state, or on this Hilbert space here. And so we can define an error criterion again here, where now we require that on average, that if you average over all the states, that the overlap is going to go to 1. The average overlap, averaged over all sequences of length n, goes to 1 as n gets large. And you can ask, what's the best rate at which you can do this? How well can you compress these n states down into nr qubits? And so Schumacher's theorem tells us that the best or the smallest compression rate is also given by the entropy, now the von Neumann entropy, where the entropy is computed on the average density operator. So the density operator that's averaged according to this ensemble here. So what you should notice is that actually this doesn't depend on the particular ensemble. Since it only depends on the average density matrix and not our choice of the ensemble, you can ask, well, what's going on here? And a common thing that people who work in quantum information theory have learned to appreciate is that often you can get further insights by whenever you have some sort of a mixed state, extending it or purifying it into a larger system. So given an ensemble that's drawn according to these probabilities right here and these states, we write down the density matrix. And it turns out that this guy can be viewed as a partial trace of its purification, which looks like this. So we can fix some purification, where now these x's here are some orthonormal basis of a purifying system. And if you trace these guys out, you just get the average ensemble state right here. So we can also interpret Schumacher compression in the sense where the sender was given part of a purified state. So rather than giving him some ensemble that's drawn according to some distributions, he was just given half of some pure state. And we can rewrite this error criterion as just this, where now you have, you know, the output state has the overlap with the nth tensor power of this purification going to one. And this is just the same formula as before. This equals that. So compressing both sides, you can show, distills the entanglement into a number of VPR pairs, roughly, that looks like this. So this is how you quantify the entanglement for pure states. Namely, you compress each side, and you can show that, you know, n copies of this state looks roughly up to invertible operations, or approximately invertible on either side, like n times the entropy EPR states. So, and it goes back and forth. So this kind of, this EPR state gives you kind of a standard metric for quantifying entanglement. But what about mixed states? So it's a much more subtle question now. So what do we mean by an entangled state? So we'll define a separable state to be a state of this form. So it's a convex combination of pure product states, or you could also define it as a convex combination of mixed product states. And so the separable states form some convex subset of all the possible quantum states on a bipartite system. So now I've got, you know, A and B. And everything that's not separable, we define to be entangled. So given a description of a quantum state written as some, just written down as a matrix, you can ask, well, is it entangled or not? And it turns out that this is a hard computational problem. It was famously shown to be NP-hard by Lean and Gurvitz in 2002. So let's ask an even harder question. How entangled is it? So then we get into this notion of entanglement measures. We want to try to quantify the entanglement, where clearly if you can show that the entanglement is positive, then at least if you have an entanglement measure that's so-called faithful, that would answer this question here. So that should be a harder thing to answer. But we can relax the question a bit and just ask, well, is it separable, or is it at least far from the set of separable states by some distance and some norm? And what I'll explain to you in this talk is that in a certain sense, for a certain definition of the distance here, this is easy. And so the main tool for proving this is going to be some recently discovered properties of quantum entropy we found through using various different tools and techniques in quantum information theory. So what are some famous examples of entanglement measures? Maybe the first one that's related to what I talked about before is called the distillable entanglement. And this just asks, how many EPR pairs can I, or how many, you know, pure or approximately pure EPR pairs can I produce from the state rho AB, where I do local operations on A and local operations on B, and I don't talk to either side. And nobody knows how to compute this in general. I should say, really, nothing here. Nobody knows how to. Does anybody know how to compute in general? But so distillable entanglement winds up being related to notions of quantum error correction and also channel capacity. That is, how well can you send quantum states over a noisy quantum channel? So kind of on the other side of the, we can ask, well, not how much can I get out of a state, but how much does it cost to create the state? So how much pure entanglement do I need on average to create n copies of the state? That's called the entanglement cost. And in general, it can cost more than you can get out of a state, and such states are called bound entangled. So a different type of measure called the relative entropy of entanglement. So this measures the distance from your state rho to the set of separable states, measured by the Kullback-Leibler distance, or the quantum relative entropy. So this is just the trace of rho against this operator here, log rho minus log sigma. And so when the state's separable, this distance is going to be zero. And as you go away, this gets bigger. So this gives you some sort of a quantification of how far away you are, and you minimize basically this distance over all possible separable states, like in this formula here. So another quantity, which I'll talk about a lot in this talk, called the squashed entanglement. And this is where you minimize a certain functional of the density matrix over all extensions into some third system C. And this is called the quantum conditional mutual information, which I'll define in a slide or two. And so it turns out that squashed entanglement sits in between these two. But before I talk about conditional mutual information, I just want to review what quantum mutual information is. So this is just a functional of bipartite density matrices that's defined in terms of the entropies of the subsystems. So we have here the mutual information between A and B evaluated on some bipartite density matrix is the entropy of A plus the entropy of B minus the joint entropy. So by these, I mean these are the entropies of the reduced density operators. And so you can kind of remember the formula from this like Venn diagram. It's like an inclusion-exclusion type thing. So it kind of tells you, at least intuitively, how much common information there is between the two systems. So there exist various operational interpretations of the mutual information in the literature. For instance, it measures the amount of effort it takes to erase the correlations between A and B, i.e. to turn the state into a product state using, say, random unitaries. You can quantify how much randomness it takes to do that. And in the limit, if you do this for rho tensor n, it winds up giving you the rate of randomness you need is given pretty much by this quantity. It also arises in describing the capacity of, say, a quantum channel, allowing the use of shared entanglement between the sender and the receiver to send classical information. But the one property that I want to focus on here is that it characterizes product states in a precise way. So namely, this quantity is zero if and only if the state is a product state like this. And furthermore, if it's approximately zero, then the state's approximately a product in this sense. So namely, we have this bound between the mutual information and the distance from the state to the product of its marginals as measured by the so-called trace distance. So what this trace distance is mathematically is just you write out this operator, you compute the singular values, and you sum them up, or it's given by this formula here. And this is sort of a standard type of distinguishability metric on quantum states. But it also has a nice operational meaning. So imagine a scenario where you're given two states, rho and sigma, or you're given one of two states that you don't know which. And you're asked to do some experiment to determine which one of these two states it is. So this experiment takes the form of a measurement or a two-outcome P of M. So in this sense, it's just two operators, M and identity minus M, such that they sum to the identity operator. So it's some partition of unity, where M is just some positive operator that lies in the interval between 0 and the identity operator. So, and we'll say that if I do this measurement and I get, you know, either this outcome or that outcome, the first outcome I get with this probability, assuming that the state was rho. So if the state was rho, I wind up declaring it's rho with trace of M rho. And otherwise, if the state was sigma, I declare it was sigma with this probability right here. So if I assume that I started off with an equal probable mixture of these two states, then the probability that I'm correct is just given by this formula here. And you can show that this guy right here is a half of the trace distance. So the maximum probability that I'm correct, maximized over all possible measurements that I can do, is given by this formula here. It's affinely related to this trace distance. So the trace distance measures the optimal bias away from just random guessing over all possible measurements that I can make for distinguishing between these two states. So in particular, if they're the same and the trace distance is zero, then all I can do is guess, and it's a half. But if they're different in the least possible way, then actually I can do strictly better than guessing by doing an optimal measurement. So what was this quantum conditional information? So this now is something that involves three systems, so A, B, and C. And now it's some measure of the correlations between, say, A and B, let's say from the perspective of somebody who already knows C. So mathematically, it's just this linear combination of four entropies listed up here. And something that makes it a little harder to deal with than in the traditional classical sense is that you can't interpret this necessarily as an average of conditional mutual information. So you can if the state was somehow blocked diagonal on C, or if it was just a classical state. But quantum mechanically, it's a little more subtle. So in fact, the operational meaning of this quantity was only really kind of uncovered a few years ago by Igor Devitak and myself. And we found that it gives that it arises as the answer to a quantum data compression problem where the sender and the receiver have quantum side information in a certain sense about the system that's being transmitted. And actually, this operational meaning plays a role in the results that I'm going to present in this talk as well. So I should also add that even just showing that this is positive is a non-trivial theorem. And this was proved in the early 70s by Lieb and Ruske. There's a lot of proofs known now, but this initial proof used some fairly heavy theorems from operator monotone functions and whatnot. So the conditions for this to equal zero are precisely that the state between A, the state from A to C to B forms a so-called quantum Markov chain. So what this basically means is that if I trace out B, that there exists some local operator from C to the joint system CB that can reconstruct the state. So somehow B doesn't have any correlations with A that aren't kind of held by C as well. So unlike in the classical case, so classically, it turns out that if this guy's approximately zero, then you're approximately close to a Markov chain in this trace distance. But quantum mechanically, this is unclear. So there's actually some negative results in this direction, which I'll mention later in the talk. So we don't know if this is true in some precise sense. But what I will show you is that we do know that if this is approximately zero, then the state on AB is approximately separable. So in this case here, if you have a Markov chain, then basically the state on AC is AB is exactly separable. So we have some notion of what it means for this to be approximately satisfied. And it's partially taking us towards being able to answer this in a better way. So let's go back to measuring entanglement. So I talked before about the relative entropy of entanglement, where you measure the distance to the set of separable states using the relative entropy. So now we can do it in terms of some norm. So for instance, with the trace norm, right? So you just take your state here, and you minimize over all states. You take the one closest to, where sep, I'm just introducing some notation for the set of separable states. And so you also have that, since this is a norm, a state's separable if and only if this distance is zero. But it turns out that for the results I'm going to describe in this talk, the trace distance is just too strong of a norm. So we use a weaker norm that maximizes over local measurements. So we have this sort of general formula here, but now we put some restrictions on the types of operators M that we can use in this variational formula. So sort of the simplest kind of protocol you can imagine is the following. So Alice does some local measurement on her system, described by this P of M, X sub X. And Bob does some one here, described by the Ys. And after they do their measurements, they get together and they compare their data. And then they'll declare it was rho if the pair was contained in some pre-agreed set. So you're optimizing over measurements, and you're optimizing over some subset here. So you can just think of this as you apply some function that maps x and y to rho or sigma. So this is describing the rho outcome. And so mathematically, you're just optimizing this thing here over operators M that satisfy this. So you have some P of VMs here, and you take some subset like that. But you can also imagine a different scenario where instead of just using local measurements or local operators, you do local operations and classical communication, one round of that. So in the sense that Alice does some measurement here, she tells Bob the result, and then Bob designs his measurement. He has a different measurement for each possible result Alice can tell him. Okay, and then they do the same thing, and then you get a little bit of a simple formula here because you just can kind of group together the POVM elements on Bob's side conditioned on Alice's, and then you get some formula like this. So it turns out that these norms here are going to be a lot smaller than the trace norm. And in fact, we have this sequence of relationships here. The non-trivial ones were shown by Matthews, Vanner, and Winter. So namely, the trace norm is an upper bound on this LCC norm, which, you know, when you go here, it gets a little smaller. And it turns out that actually this gives you an upper bound on the 2 norm, or the Frobenius norm. This is the trace of x squared for Hermitian operators. And in turn, this upper bound is the trace norm again, but we have to divide by the square root of the dimension. So these are all dimension-independent bounds. So throughout this talk, when I write a norm unqualified like this, you can think of any of these norms that you like. So these all these results will hold for the LOCC and will therefore imply bounds on these lower ones as well. No. It's probably not optimal either, but I don't really, it's just an artifact of how they proved it. It's some messy combinatorial calculation using like representation theory that they compute a bunch of operators and they bound it. So I don't know if it's optimal or not. My guess is that it's not. So when is a state separable and when is it not? So one nice thing is that if you have a separable state, you can share the correlations, or you can copy one of the systems as many times as you want. So given some separable state here, I can view this as a partial trace of some system where I copy B out as many times as I want. So each row X can just be replicated like this. And so we'll say that separable states are extendable as often as you like. So we can make a definition, and we'll define, for just a general state that's not necessarily separable, we'll define a symmetric K extension as some state on A tensored with K copies of B, such that it's symmetric under interchange of the B systems, and such that if I trace out all the B's but one, I get back the original state. So this gives me a hierarchy of conditions that are satisfied by separable states. So namely, I have the set of all states here, and there's a subset, it winds up being convex, of states that have a 2 extension. And inside that, you have the 3 extendable ones. You go on and, inside this set of infinitely extendable states, you have the separable states. And it turns out that they're the same. So every entangled state is going to fail some test. So if the state's entangled, there exists some K such that it's not K extendable. And so this suggests a potential algorithm for determining if a state is separable. So to show that a state is separable, you just want to look for a K extension for some K. And if it's, for it to be entangled, you want to show that it doesn't, that some K extension doesn't exist. So the problem is that you might have to check infinitely many K to make this work. So really, a better way to phrase this would be in terms of what people call in computer science a weak membership problem. So here, given some density matrix rho AB, and given some error parameter epsilon as an input to the algorithm, you ask the question, well, is it separable, or is it at least epsilon away in some distance? And here I'm going to mean one of these local norms. So is it here or is it there? With the promise that only one can happen. And so what I'll show you in this talk is that we actually have this bound here on the distance to the set of separable states for a state that is K extendable. So if you can copy the correlations K times, then it can't be too far away from the set of separable states. It's upper bounded by this quantity here that grows like the log of the size of A over the number of times you can extend it. So besides implying that this hierarchy before was complete, because if the state has a K extension for every K, this has to be 0, it suggests an algorithm that actually was originally pointed out by Doherty, Perillo, and Spedalieri in 04, which just asks, you just look for a K extension where K is roughly of this size. And so it turns out that you can solve this problem using a semi-definite program that has a running time that grows like this, which winds up being what we call quasi-polynomial in A and B. So it's the exponential of some polynomial in the logs of these guys. So in particular, if one of these systems is constant, it's polynomial time. And it's probably polynomial time in general, but we just don't know how to prove it. So I should say that the best known bound before was actually exponentially worse. Yes? I never said that, but yes, they are. Thanks. So the best known bound before was exponentially worse. So here we have something that scales like the log of the dimension of A. And the best known bound before went like the square of the dimension of B. Okay, and this was based on a finite quantum version of something called the Diffinetti theorem, which in some sense characterizes the distance of symmetric states from the set of separable states, and built on work by all these people here. So at the beginning, I mentioned that this problem was NP-hard. But here I'm talking about we have an effectively polynomial time algorithm for this. So what's going on? So in 2002, what Gurvitz really showed was that this weak membership problem was NP-hard if one of this distance scaled exponentially in the dimensions of the systems. And this was improved to a polynomial gap by Garibian in 2008. And you might ask, well, what if this gap grows like a polylog or something in the dimensions? So in there, it's still going to take this quasi-polynomial time. But it turns out that this would violate some things people believe from complexity theory. So realizing I might not have mentioned this, but it's really important here that this gap here is a constant for this to work. Okay, so for any constant size gap, you have a polynomial time algorithm. Whereas here, this is for gaps that are scaling. So if the gap is getting smaller as the dimension grows, it can be a hard problem. But for just a constant distance, that's where this becomes an efficient algorithm. So I mentioned this bound here, this Diffinetti-like bound, and how do we prove it? And that's where the real work comes in. It's proved by using a whole lot of techniques from information theory. So, in particular, uses some recent results that we proved about the squashed entanglement. So I mentioned before we had this conditional mutual information. And the conditional mutual information is defined by minimizing, or I should say the squashed entanglement is defined by minimizing the conditional mutual information over all extensions of the state rho AB into some third system C, such that when you trace out C, you get back the original state. And so it seems to be hard to compute in general, namely because we don't know any actual bound on the size of C that is going to achieve this. So this is an infimum and not a minimum. It might be that you do this optimization for some size of C, you get a number, you increase the size of C, it gets smaller, you keep increasing the size of C, you get some sequence of numbers that goes down, and maybe it limits to some final number, but maybe it's not achieved on any finite dimensional size system. Or maybe it is, we just don't know. So despite this problem with computing the squashed entanglement, it actually has a number of nice properties. So namely, it's normalized in the sense that it's upper bounded by the log of the dimension or the entropy of one of the sides, of either one of the sides. And actually, on pure states, it just reduces down to the usual, the entanglement of half of the system. And it's also monogamous in this following sense. It satisfies this monogamy inequality, which roughly says that A can't be maximally entangled with B1 and B2 at the same time. So if it's fully entangled with B1, then this guy has to be 0. And this is sort of an approximate version of that. So only recently did we show that the squash entanglement is faithful, that it faithfully detects entanglement in the following sense. So it's actually not hard to show that squash entanglement vanishes on separable states. I'll show you that on the next slide. But the converse question was open for almost 10 years, namely to show that if the state's entangled, is the squash entanglement strictly positive? So this was hard. And it's hard because of this bound here. So it could have been, or the fact that we don't have a bound here. So it could have been that the squash entanglement is 0, but you kind of need larger and larger sizes of C in order to achieve that. And it turns out not to be the case. But I'll add that because of the fact that it's faithful, that implies that it's NP-hard to compute, because then you could solve the separability problem exactly if you could compute this thing efficiently. So we shouldn't be too surprised that we don't have these bounds in general in the size of C. So how do we show that it vanishes on separable states? This is easy. So let's say I have some separable state on rho AB, and I just basically put a flag on C that tells you which member of the separable decomposition or the product decomposition you are. And then it turns out that if I evaluate the conditional mutual information on this state here, it's just the average now over C. And for each value of C, it's a product state, so each one of those things is 0, and this guy here gives you 0. But again, it's unclear a priori that this is positive on entangled states because of the lack of any sort of a general dimension bound. If we had a general dimension bound, this would immediately follow. But we don't know how to bound the size of C as a function of, say, the size of A and B. But this follows from this new bound, which I'll present in this talk. Namely, we showed that the conditional mutual information, so by we, this is Fernando Brandão, Matthias Christendel, and myself, we showed that the conditional mutual information between A and B given C is an upper bound on this local norm distance from the state rho AB to the set of separable states. No, times some constant, which is, I think, an eighth. So in particular, this is independent of the extension C. And that's the important part, that this right-hand side doesn't depend at all on which extension we pick. Therefore, it immediately gives us a bound on the squash entanglement as well, because this is clearly satisfied by the minimum of this quantity over all C. And that immediately gives us that the squash entanglement is faithful. So this new bound here, this is the main thing we want to know how to prove. So what are some other consequences of this? Well, so we have this strong subadditivity bound of Lieben-Rosky, which tells us that this is positive. And so it was also shown by Hayden, Joseph, Petz, and Winter in 03 that when this guy is equal to 0, that this implies that the state on rho AB is exactly separable. And in fact, that you have this Markov chain property that goes from A to C to B. So it was an open question to what extent this result here, or the stronger Markov property, held approximately. So this partially resolves this. It tells us at least something. It tells us that when this is approximately 0, then you're approximately close to the set of separable states in this local norm, again. So we don't know if we have any sort of dimension-independent bound for trace norm or not. So, and I should also add that so far, we pretty much only had negative results along these lines, proved by Ibbotson, Linden, and Winter, which I'll mention a bit at the end. So it was a little surprising that this was able to be made to work. So, and in particular, using this bound, there's this bound here, we get basically a one-line proof of this Definiti theorem for an n-extendable state. So if rho AB has an n-extension, then we know that if we work with the n-extension from A to n copies of B, that this is upper bounded by the log of the size of A by this normalization property. And then by monogamy, this itself is an upper bound on n times the squash entanglement to just one copy of B. And then we have this bound on the squash entanglement that came right from here. And then that gives us this property right there. So you divide by n, take the square root, and then that's this Definiti thing that I mentioned here. So how do we prove this bound? So it followed from a chain of new inequalities in quantum information theory. So roughly described like this. And so what are these quantities? So here, this d global and d local, these measure the optimal error rate at which you can distinguish n copies of the state rho from the set of separable states with one-sided error instead of with two-sided error. And so when we define these norms in terms of distinguishability, we said assume that you get this state or the other state with equal probabilities, and you want to minimize the average error probability. So here, what we now ask is that we want to make sure that when the state was rho, that we declare it was rho with probability going to 1 at any rate. I don't really care how fast, but I really want to minimize the rate at which I make a mistake in this direction. So if it was separable, I don't want to declare that it was rho. I want to make that rate be as small as possible and to go down by n, or by some rate d, 2 to the minus dn. And the smallest d, or the largest d, is going to be this. So in the following sense. So if I allow global measurements, it's going to be d global. And if I do this local measurement, or if I have this local measurement constraint, then it's going to be d local. And so what we showed was that this quantity here is an upper bound on the difference between the rates at which you can distinguish, say, either if you have all three systems or just A and C, forgetting about B. And that this here is then, in turn, an upper bound on our ability to distinguish row AB from the set of separable states using local measurements. So not just global measurements, like in the trace norm, but local ones, like in these local norms here. And then using sort of some more standard techniques, like a Chernoff type bound, this gives us, in turn, an upper bound on this norm distance. So how did we prove these steps? So these steps followed basically from this first step used this operational interpretation of quantum conditional mutual information found by Igor Devitak and myself. We found that this is some optimal communication rate for a certain problem, which I don't want to get into. And the next was a result by Plenio and Brendau, where they showed that this D global, this should be D, is given by the so-called regularized relative entropy of entanglement. So this is just like the relative entropy distance, but now you compute it on n copies of rho against a set of separable states across, let's say, an and bn. So just separable across all the a's and all the b's, from all the a's to all the b's, and divide by n and take the limit. So they found an operational interpretation for this quantity that was given precisely by this D global, where you're trying to distinguish rho tensor n from any separable state, not just a product separable state. And I should add that this result in and of itself relies on other techniques, like this other Diffinetti theorem that I mentioned earlier. So there's a lot that kind of goes into providing this bound here. With that said, I want to maybe, for the last bit of time, speculate on some possible connections and applications of these results, and maybe of possible extensions of these results as well. So, and one would be towards trying to get a better handle on or understanding of the notion of topological order and how to quantify it. So imagine that I have some 2D system that's in, let's say, the ground state of some local Hamiltonian that's gapped. So there's some energy gap between the ground state and the next excited states. And so an area law, if true and for such a system, would tell you that the entropy of some region A grows like, some constant times the length of the boundaries of the system. But there would also be some sort of universal correction here that is given by something called the total quantum dimension of the system. So if a system's topologically ordered, you expect it to have some number of super selection sectors that describe the different quasi-particle excitations or anionic excitations in the system. And if a system is not topologically ordered, you'll only expect a vacuum state, or a vacuum in this setting here. So basically, this D would be 1, and then its log would be 0. You wouldn't have this correction. But this correction, if present, would be some sort of a signature of the presence of topological order. So if this guy's positive, it gets sort of subtracted off of the number of times equal to the number of boundary components in the system like this. So this D here, or this vector of D, is a vector of so-called quantum dimensions of the different superselection sectors. So what the quantum dimension is, basically, it says that if I have, say, n particles of type I, or n of these collective excitations of type I, the global Hilbert space of those systems is going to be some kind of non-local Hilbert space that grows roughly like the quantum dimension raised to the n. So for large n. And you can sort of access this Hilbert space by braiding the particle excitations around each other. And you can prepare states by, say, creating particle-antiparticle pairs out of the vacuum. You can measure by bringing them back together and seeing if they annihilate. And there are various proposals for doing quantum computation in topologically ordered systems by using these types of techniques. So people would love to see anions. It hasn't quite happened yet. Might have happened very recently, but I think I'm not entirely sure. So again, this quantity here, the topological entanglement entropy, is going to be positive when a system is topologically ordered. So it was kind of defined, this topological entanglement entropy, around the exact same time in a paper by Kataev and Preskill and another paper by Levin and Wen. And so what they did was kind of assume some general form, at least this is how the Cataya-Preskill derivation goes. You assume some general form of the entropy, namely that you have some area law here minus some sort of non-universal or some sort of universal correction like this. And take your medium and split it up into four subsystems. So you have some pure state on ABCD. If you trace out D, you then have some tripartite density matrix on ABC, or the same thing here on ABC like this. And you compute this entropy functional, this JABC, which is just given by this alternating sum of the entropies of the system. So you subtract off the individual entropies, you add in the entropies of the pairs, and you subtract off the triple. And what you find when you do this is that all of the divergent terms cancel, okay, and you're left with some multiple of this last guy here. And so in particular, in the Cataya-Preskill derivation, they did some sort of clever TQFT calculation where they glued the medium to its time reversal conjugate, and they put sort of wormholes through here, and they somehow reduced the problem down to computing the entropies of various 3 and 4 punctured spheres using topological field theory techniques. And the Levin and Wen method uses a slightly different layout for the way of breaking this into subsystems and makes an assumption that the system can be described using a so-called string net model. And they get agreeing results up to some factor of 2, but that has to do more with the difference in topology than anything else. So what, if anything, do these results that we have about conditional mutual information and separability tell us about topological entanglement entropy? So they say a little bit at this point, but I have a feeling that if pushed further, we would get a lot more insight. So what we know is that, so Hastings proved some years ago that if you assume that you have some gapped Hamiltonian, that the distance as measured by connected correlation functions goes to zero exponentially in the distance between the two regions that you move apart. Now, it would be really nice if this held in the sense of, say, trace distance, then it would immediately imply an area law. But it doesn't. We don't know if this holds in general in that setting, and it probably doesn't because of the existence of so-called data hiding states. But so let's say we forget about a gap, and let's just say that we just assume that in this sort of a topology that the conditional mutual information between A and B given C is approximately zero. So that tells us that the state is at least approximately separable across here. So it's not quite going as far as telling us what we'd like to know about an area law, but maybe somehow this could be used to or strengthened to show some sort of an area law in these types of settings. So I should mention that this really only lets us say something about the Levin and Wen topology here and not the Preskill-Cataev, because what happens when we compute the conditional mutual information of this setting right here, we get some divergent term here. So nonetheless, we might be able to say something about this where in sort of a different setting, where instead of imagining that we have some, that this is some bulk theory, imagine that this is the boundary, okay? So maybe it's a two-dimensional boundary or some three-dimensional theory, or just imagine sort of an analogous thing where I break up the boundary into regions A, B, and C. That there might be something interesting that we can say about such states, but there is. So the reason for that is, as shown by Cassini and Huerta, that despite the fact that you can have the entropies divergent, that this quantity here is actually going to be finite for when these guys grow like the area of these regions and not just the area of the boundary. But there's some sort of subtleties, namely, if I consider this as like, if I have some topologically ordered system and I have a CFT on the boundary, or just some general conformal, if this is just, if I'm breaking up some, if I have a conformal field theory in general, I guess I should say, not just in two dimensions, that this quantity is going to be finite despite the lack of any sort of a conformally invariant tensor product structure. So it would be nice if there's something that could be said about the structure of these states, even though we can't quite break up their tensor products, because we have some finite quantity here that might potentially lead to a way to do that. So I just want to say a little bit here about a completely different type of problem, namely that of communicating information over a quantum channel, or protecting quantum information from quantum noise that's described by a quantum channel. So by a quantum channel, I just mean a completely positive trace-preserving map, or in other words, something where I have some quantum system here that undergoes some unitary evolution with some environment that starts off in some pure state, and the environment is inaccessible to the sender or the receiver, so it kind of gets zapped away, and this process causes noise to happen as you go from system A to system B. And so we can, in the spirit of Shannon, talk about the capacity of the channel in the following sense. So imagine I start off with, you know, Alice is presented with some qubits in some states that are unknown to her. Maybe they're even entangled with something else that she doesn't know about. And Alice does some encoding quantum operation here, also given by a completely positive trace-preserving map, into the states that you present on the input of some communication channels. So maybe these are fiber optic cables like this, and she, you know, turns, sort of teleports the state of these atoms into some photons, or into a subspace of the space of, say, n photons. Let's say nr, the rate she sends out is r. They undergo some noise, and then Bob, at the end of the day, tries to decode it and reproduce the state over here that Alice was presented there. So the quantum capacity is going to be given by the maximum ratio between the number of encoded qubits and the number of transmissions that Alice needs to make. And again, we use this similar type of information theoretic constraint here, where we require that the error goes to zero, and you can define the error in many different ways. And the quantum capacity gives us the ultimate or fundamental bound on our ability to perform quantum error correction under sort of independent noise of this type. So we don't know how to compute the quantum capacity in general. We just know, we kind of have bounds where we can do it for certain cases. But so a somewhat surprising result that I found some years ago with Graham Smith and was that there exist pairs of channels, each of which has zero capacity. So, you know, you use the channel N1 as many times as you want, and you can't get through any rate of information, communication. And same with this other channel here, N2. So you can't get any quantum information through reliably. But somehow, if you're able to use the channels together, that there's some joint encoder that exists that would let you get things through at a positive rate. So just in equations, you know, the quantum capacity of N1 and the quantum capacity of N2 are zero, but that of their tensor product is strictly positive. So also with Graham and with John Smolin, we found that this can also persist for so-called Gaussian channels. So channels that are just built out of linear and nonlinear optical elements. So you could in principle even potentially see this in a laboratory, or at least build the types of channels for which this could occur in a laboratory. So it's not just some mathematical result. So when we initially found this result here, we found it on the basis of trying to understand this formula for a so-called assisted capacity for quantum communication, where you imagine that you start off with your channel, say N1, and you allow arbitrary access to some second channel, N2, that maps into the symmetric subspace of the output in the environment. So such channels necessarily have zero capacity, because if they had a positive capacity, they would allow you to do cloning. You could do quantum cloning, because anything you could decode at the output, the environment could also decode. So because of that, it was actually conjectured that this formula here should equal the quantum capacity, because if it didn't, it would imply that you had non-additivity of quantum capacity, which nobody really believed would happen. So the reason I write this formula here is that, once again, this formula was an attractive formula as a past conjecture of what the quantum capacity should be, because it seems to be sort of a nice closed form solution. But part of the problem is that this system C here, again, so I wrote max, I really should have written soup, because again, we don't know if this is achieved on any finite size C. So the best formula that we've had before for the best formula we have for quantum capacity involves, again, one of these regularizations. So it's like maybe C is kind of holding on to the regularization, and you really need this infinite limit, or maybe there's some bound here. So trying to understand the range of different values that quantum conditional mutual information can take over all extensions is an important thing that lies outside of just trying to understand the nature of entanglement. So at this point, I'll conclude and just mention some questions that come out of this work. So first and foremost, we would really like to prove some sort of a dimension bound for squash entanglement. So if you could prove this kind of a thing in general, you would immediately prove that it's faithful without having to go through all this other information theory, but it wouldn't necessarily imply all these other results. Can we study entanglement without recourse to some sort of an obvious tensor product structure? So for example, if you have non-abelian anions, it makes sense to talk about product states without necessarily having some sort of a tensor product structure. As well as, if you have boundary states or states of some conformal field theory, the entropy is something that you need to renormalize. It diverges, okay? But all the divergent terms kind of cancel out for conditional mutual information of, say, two, if you have three different regions. So despite that fact, and actually even in operator algebras, I mean, relative entropy is also known to exist in certain settings where you don't even have a faithful trace, like certain type 3 von Neumann algebras and whatnot, which actually are the mathematical versions of the fields in a conformal field theory. So it might be that some other version of squash entanglement where instead of minimizing overall extensions, you maximize overall extensions, that this could be a more relevant thing to study, or that might give further insights to topological order in general. So if we go back to this setting here, right? So if you have an area law, you expect that you're going to have something that looks like a product state between A and B, but that somehow putting in this system C increases the correlation. So I have AB given C, if it's topologically ordered, it's going to be something that's larger. So it's just an example of how we would like to understand where the different, how much this can vary as you take different extensions of the system. So also it would be very, very nice if we could say something about the structure of the global state. Okay, so namely, if I have this quantity here, small, you'd like to be able to say that the state from A to C to B looks close to a Markov chain. And so far, pretty much, there's only been negative results in this direction. Namely, if you take the relative entropy distance from the state here to the set of quantum Markov chains, this is actually lower bounded by the conditional mutual information, not upper bounded by it. So, and this is a result of Ibbotson, Linden, and Winter. But this, there still are many other options here. So maybe it might well be that the regularized version could be smaller, or that we could work in some suitable norm and have a lower bound here as well. Because this thing here is even just an upper bound on the trace norm. So the trace norm could still be smaller than this, would be consistent. And also, in general, we want to understand conditional mutual information because it also arises in characterizing things like channel capacities and various network problems as well. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
It looks like John is staying to take questions. So,
So when you were discussing this measure, this quantifying of entanglement, so if I understood, you considered a situation where you had the separable space, then you had a little sort of band of Cygnus epsilon, and then you had the other ones that you were trying to distinguish from the separable states, and you were taking a limit in which the dimension was going, something was going to infinity.
Right. Well, I was considering the complexity as a function of the dimension.
Yeah. So the dimension was going. So the question is, how much of the volume of the state space is in that little band, this function of n? Is it a sort of negligible amount, or does it get bigger as n gets bigger?
I'm actually not sure. So you're asking, is it like a constant fraction or something? Or?
Yeah, because I mean, if it was getting to zero, then it would be a very good detection. But if it was going to one as the fraction, then it would be a very poor detection.
Right, well, I don't think it's going to one. Yeah, I'm not sure. Is there a question?
I was surprised not to see the square root in the finite bound, because I was used to the older version that has no square root, just
right.
1 over n. So do you think it is an artifact of the technique, of the proof technique, or maybe it's something that if you want to have that kind of complexity bound, you really need the square root?
I mean, the square root was, I mean, the real exciting thing was the log,
yes.
Not so much the square root.
Yes.
So, where was it? I mean, so I mean, maybe it's, you know, it's really the square root scaling with k that you might be surprised by. But I mean, it's really just some. Where exactly is it? Well, it would come in here. In this sort of churn up, so this churn up bound step right there.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe you could do without it. I'm not entirely sure.
So keeping the linear scale.
Well, I mean, you could also use this distinguishability measure here, which, I mean, I'm not entirely sure how optimal this step is. I think you probably lose a lot in going to this anyway.
Yeah.
I think.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Are there any more questions?
So could you say something? I mean, you did explain it, but it went by pretty quickly, about the intuition behind this universal term in the entanglement. The area law is then corrected by something that is essentially measuring the number of, I guess, the number of global states or something. Dimension of the, some combination of the dimensions.
So, well, I know that this...
If you can even starting, why is it negative, for example?
I guess it's negative because really you should move it over to this side. And so the entropy, the amount of entanglement kind of across the boundary is going to go like the entropy of the region plus some extra sort of global entanglement that is sort of underlying. So I mean, the best intuitive explanation I've seen for where this comes from is, I guess you can describe things like torque code from like with like a mirror. The GIF ray stuff, and the idea is that this topological Hilbert space is kind of the input to the whole state, and then you can kind of grow the state out, and this topological sector kind of is some non-local Hilbert space that is coded across the whole system here.
But this works even, I mean, those degenerate ground states, you usually need some non-trivial topology, like a torus or something like that.
Well, I mean, you can forget about...
But this is working even if you had sort of asymptotically flat or whatever. I mean, if you had an infinite plane. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. Any more questions? If not, let me just remind you that there are post-colloquium snacks downstairs in the bistro. So let's thank John Winston.